of the Eastern Conference semifinals at the Fiserv Forum last night. The series now tied one game apiece. Game three is Friday night in Boston. Also last night, Golden State beat Houston 115-109. Tonight, Portland plays Denver. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, May 1st. Should be cloudy and seasonal, with rain and fog off and on throughout the day, a high of 56. Overnight, 43 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy and seasonal, 70% chance of more rain. Tomorrow's high, 58. Some drizzle now, 45 Racine, 47 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and the competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is the music of British composer Gerald Finzi, and that is the opening movement of his suite drawn from his incidental music to Love's Labour's Lost. This is an early comedy by the great William Shakespeare, and it is one of those plays that is not done all that often, and so it is a rare treat when one has the opportunity to see it live. You have that opportunity this coming weekend and the following weekend at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. They are performing Shakespeare's Love's Labour's Lost. And my guest for the first part of today's morning show is Brian Gill, who is part of the theater faculty at UW Parkside and the director of this production. Brian Gill, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Always good to see you.
Glad to have you here. And it's always fun to have the opportunity to learn a little something about a work that is for most people just a name, just a title, and probably for a whole lot of people, they've never ever heard of this. I want to say that my most direct acquaintance with Love's Labour's Lost is the music that we just played, and the fact that probably the single most unforgettable hour of television I can ever remember was an episode of ER from the first season that was called Love's Labour's Lost. Have you ever seen it?
I haven't seen that, no.
It's could not be more different than this play. It's a very tragic story about a woman who experiences tragic complications in her pregnancy. And ultimately, although the baby is saved, she does not survive the ordeal. And it's, I mean, honestly, the most wrenching hour of television I have ever seen. And the name of that award-winning episode is Love's Labour's Lost. And I remember not too long after finding out that that title was not just conjured up out of nowhere, but it was actually pulled from the title of this Shakespeare play, which I just assumed at that point was some sort of terrible tragedy as well. And in fact, Love's Labour's Lost is a sparkling comedy, and apparently one that in which Shakespeare really demonstrated some tremendous ingenuity. So enough of my understanding of Love's Labour's Lost. Let's get on to the person who knows a whole lot more about it. First of all, Brian, tell us a little bit about why this ended up being selected. And did you have a hand in this choice to be part of this year's Parkside theatrical season?
Yes, I did. One of the tricky things about Shakespeare, Shakespeare's plays, is that obviously they're large casts, and when Shakespeare was writing and performing these plays, there were no women actors. So the great struggle in casting Shakespeare is the fact that you have all of these amazing male roles, and then you've got two or maybe three really strong female roles. So when we were planning our season, we wanted to make sure that there was really good opportunity for our female actors as well as our male actors, which can be surprisingly tricky, unless you want to do an all-female cast of this or really do a lot of serious gender bending. And so we were talking about the plays and trying to figure out what we wanted to do. And I really like Love's Labors. I've always been fond of it. And I thought, okay, well, that gives us, our four strong male leads as well as four strong female leads. There's a smaller female lead that's part of the what are known as the rustics, the kind of the locals, the non-aristocrats. And then if I take this one role, it's easy enough to shift that role from male to female. And that gives me a good handful. It's not even, but that gives me several. The cast is now comprised of a good difference between male and female roles, and it's fun. Any time you can show people that Shakespeare is irreverent and silly and modern English as it was. We just happened to be looking at it 400 years after the fact.
Right. It seems like Shakespeare is always in the mix in a Parkside theatrical season. Am I right about that? Year in and year out?
Yeah, oftentimes it's every other year. We try to do a classical piece in our season every year. For quite a while, it was every year, and then we did a Molière, and then shifted back. But I think it's very important to produce these plays and for people to see these plays.
So from the little study that I did, it sounds like this was a relatively early play by Shakespeare. Tell us where this kind of falls within the framework of his career as a playwright.
Sure. It always struck me as, it was one of his early comedies. It was written in the mid-1590s, first published in quarto in 1598. And it's kind of this young hotshot playwright strutting his stuff a little bit, newish on the scene. The play is very much a battle of the sexes between the lords of Navarre and the ladies of France, and their weapons are language. And the wordplay in this play is amazing, and it's a lot of it is rhyming verse, which is always a sign of showing off. Look how clever I am. Somebody says something and it ends with this word, and the next person drops their thought using a word that rhymes with the word that was just used, or playing on each other's language.
So it's not a character standing there, in a sense, reciting a couplet, reciting
no.
a play that rhymes.
God,
it's,
no.
It's dialogue that rhymes, and there's something really special about that.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I am a huge proponent of no fourth wall in Shakespeare. Shakespeare didn't write plays to be performed on a proscenium stage. He didn't write plays with the idea that the audience sits quietly in the dark and observes what's going on. The audience in Elizabethan theater is a part of the story. They're the final puzzle piece. So the actors, I found moments and encouraged the actors in this production to talk directly to the audience. There's a point where one of the characters is in the audience for a scene, so that you know, ideally, the audience is a part of the story and don't feel they don't feel like passive observers. They feel like they're in on the ride.
Hmm. So tell our listeners kind of the heart and soul of this story of this king and his three companions and this improbable project, in a sense, that they undertake.
Sure. Well, the King of Navarre decides he is going to lock down the kingdom for 3 years.
And by the way, what is Navarre?
Oh, my Lord. Navarre is the kingdom in which the play takes place.
And is that a completely fictional
place?
No,
it's now a part of Spain, but it was its own kingdom.
I think now that makes sense to
me. Yeah, my assumption is it sounds kind of mysterious and foreign, which of course the Elizabethans would have been all over.
Right.
But so the king decides that he and his three lords will lock themselves away from the world, essentially, and focus on academics. They will almost starve themselves from food. Women are banned from they're not allowed to come within a mile of the kingdom. And the kingdom of Navarre will become what he refers to as a little academe.
Hmm.
And, of course, that would be a profoundly boring story. So we then suddenly find out that the Princess of France is on her way for diplomatic reasons, because there is not another kingdom, but there is a land dispute going on between her father and that was going on between her father and the King of Navarre's father over Aquitaine.
Hmm.
It is a plot that is brought up at the very beginning of the play and then is never mentioned again.
Okay.
But so
a convenient plot contrivance.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, shamelessly so. So the princess is there. She arrives. So they are forced to have to deal with this situation. And, of course, the princess has brought three of her ladies with her. And
how handy.
Exactly. And love and wackiness immediately breaks out, with all of the lords trying to pursue the ladies but not let each other know they're doing so. And it's there are glimmers of a lot of the fun comedic silliness that appears in many of Shakespeare's other plays. There's overhearing of letters, and there's eavesdropping, and there's mistaken identity and disguise. Mm. And it's just a lot of fun.
Hmm. So each of these men, at least most of the time, is trying to give the appearance of being faithful to their abstinence when in fact they're not being.
Absolutely. Yep. And then, of course, it all collapses upon them.
as things absolutely must. So in a little just cursory glance at a few facts about Love's Labour's Lost, one of the things I read is that this play contains the longest single word found in any Shakespeare play. Does that sound
it does.
Like it's true?
It contains the longest word, it contains the longest scene, and it contains the longest monologue. Now, this I worked on from several different cuttings of this script, because I really wanted to streamline it. I wanted to point out the comedy of it, and I wanted to really make it about these eight young people and their it sounds cliche, but their journey from, in some ways, from carefree immaturity to suddenly having to be adults. So the longest word in Shakespeare's plays does not appear in this production. But I'll get it wrong, but the word, and I for the life of me can't remember what it means, but the word is honorificabilitudinitatibus.
Ah, okay.
Say that five. Say that once fast. No,
yeah, I'm not even going to try once. But
but the long speech is in there, and it's not the what people may think of as, you know, the stereotypical, oh dear Lord, here comes the big speech. It's a beautiful speech. The lords have found each other out, and Barone is asked to kind of help them justify the fact that they're breaking their words, and he just drops this amazing speech about love and women's eyes and what can be learned through gazing into them, and it's a cracker of a speech.
Wow, it sounds like a great play, and it sounds like there's no particular reason why it should be as obscure as it is. Do you have any theories on why this has been crowded off by other plays by Shakespeare, including other comedies that are much better known?
Yeah, I think as I said, there is a lot of wordplay. They're all language plays, but there's it's a similar thing with Merry Wives of Windsor, which at its heart is the great 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 grandmother of the sitcom. You know, I mean, it's kind of an I Love Lucy episode. but there's within Merry Wives of Windsor, there are a lot of jokes that don't translate anymore. You know, just kind of like when you see a film from the 90s or a TV show from the 80s, and there's a very specific reference that was hysterical.
That was hysterical, yes.
that was absolutely hysterical at the time because it was so specific. But 20 years down the road, everyone goes, what does that mean? Hmm. 400 years down the road, it's even further gone.
Hmm.
So as a director, you try to look, you know, you try to find what you can use from that. And sometimes we're not going to do this little chunk, or this plot line isn't helping the story that this production wants to tell.
Mm-hmm.
The honorificabilitudinitatibus, though very funny and very clever, didn't really serve what I wanted to do with this production.
Interesting. So you're trying to serve up this play in a way where it will really land with audiences of 2019.
Absolutely. And encourage the radical thought that Shakespeare can be very fun and doesn't have to be 3 hours long and can be silly. There's a huge amount of silly in this production.
Hmm. Silly is okay, especially when we're talking about a comedy. So very good. What does the production look like? Are you doing this in a way that is, at least in a rough sense, authentic? Or are you doing something with the setting that is out of the ordinary?
We've set this production in around about 1927.
Hmm.
And part of my reasoning for that was it made real sense to me. So you've got the king and his lords that they kind of just lurch from one extreme to the other in this play. And I thought in looking for an interesting time period to set this play in, the 20s made great sense because we had just come out of the horrors of World War I, death and destruction on a scale that, you know, mankind didn't even know we were capable of. So well done there. and then there was this absolute headlong sprint into the opposite of that with the Roaring Twenties, or the French refer to as the Crazy Years.
Hmm.
That you go from death and destruction on a grand scale to jazz and booze and dancing, and essentially the 1920s equivalent of sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Hmm.
And that spoke to me in regards to what the lords were trying to do. And if they, logically following that through, if these characters were veterans of the First World War, then they would absolutely lurch toward the opposite, right? So they come home and they're going kind of crazy, and the king says, enough of this, we're going to become philosophers and academics. And then the ladies arrive and they lurch, you know, from that to this new pursuit, and then at the end of the play, without any giving away any spoilers, they all are put in a situation where they need to decide whether or not they're going to grow up.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Brian Gill, and we're talking about Shakespeare's comedy Love's Labour's Lost, which is going to be performed at UW Parkside this weekend and the following weekend. So it is a relatively rare opportunity to enjoy this early comedy by Shakespeare that just does not show up nearly as often as Comedy of Errors or Taming of the Shrew or A Midsummer Night's Dream, let alone the big tragedies that also occupy so many seasons. This is Shakespeare that's just a little bit out of the ordinary, uncommonly seen on, especially on local stages, and here it is at Parkside this weekend and the next. So generally speaking, Brian Gill, when you are working with students, what is their attitude regarding Shakespeare? Is this an opportunity that, by and large, they tend to welcome, or is it more of kind of a eat your broccoli, it's good for you kind of scenario? I mean, and I'm sure it's not easy to generalize or summarize, but I mean, surely you have some kind of sense of that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, all of that, a combination, you know. There is excitement, there is intimidation. I've been very fortunate in my training with Shakespeare, having trained at the Globe Theatre in London with true masters of the craft. I've been very fortunate with my professional career, acting career, of working with people that get Shakespeare and hear Shakespeare and have the ability to teach Shakespeare. Because if you can't understand the words, it becomes, for audiences, I believe, it becomes an exercise in how stupid am I? And no one likes that, rightfully so. And I think it feeds into the idea of Shakespeare is for boring, smart people. Whereas Shakespeare was writing for an audience that the majority of whom were uneducated. They couldn't read and they couldn't write. And on top of that, Shakespeare was literally inventing words and expanding the English language. So I always go back to, how is it that an uneducated groundling, right, the people who stood on the ground to watch the play, could understand Shakespeare and went to all of his shows religiously, and yet people with undergraduate degrees and master's degrees don't get Shakespeare and don't like Shakespeare.
Right.
So my job then becomes making sure the actors in the production know what they're saying and why they're saying it, and they know all of the vocabulary. They know the meaning. They know the intent. And sometimes it is as technical as me saying, you know what, Greg, in this sentence, lift this word. Mm. And then they do, and suddenly everyone goes, oh, I heard it, you know. Mm. Or it's, hey, Greg, what does this phrase mean? And you say, oh, I don't know because I didn't look it up. And okay, well, there's your problem. So it's one part teaching it as you go, and then one part directing it. And once any actor, once whether it's a student actor or it's an actor who's been in the business forever, once that actor starts hearing Shakespeare, once Shakespeare makes that leap from 400-year-old archaic English, which it's not, it is 400 years old, but it's not archaic. Once it makes that leap from that to sounding like it was written last Tuesday, everybody starts getting very, very excited.
Hmm.
And it becomes a whole different ballgame.
Right. How difficult is it for your students to memorize Shakespeare? Does it fall easily on the brain when it comes to that
right
matter?
Yeah. when Shakespeare is writing in verse, especially rhyming verse, so meaning the heightened language, the poetry, that if you want to bore somebody, you refer to it as iambic pentameter and watch them gloss over. But it's a rhythm to it, right? It's da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, unstressed, stressed, unstressed, stressed, unstressed, stressed, et cetera. And there are 10 beats to each line. So there's a musicality to it.
Mm.
It's actually... It's naturally the way that our vocal patterns fall out. English speaking, vocal patterns fall out. So that helps because it's like, you know, how you can learn a song really quick, you know, because there's a musicality to it. And then if it's rhyming verse, you know, okay, the last word rhymes with this, and it's got these ba 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 ba. So I'm halfway through the line. I know the next word has three syllables, you know, so you can kind of find your way through. If it's not written in verse, then it's written in prose, and that can be, you know, that's just the way that it looks like a paragraph, you know, and sometimes that can be a little trickier. But it's just, as with anything, if you don't understand the meaning of what you are trying to memorize, it's going to be a monster to memorize.
Yeah, I should think.
Yeah.
It'd be like memorizing nonsense syllables.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So they're pretty quick at it. This cast was very quick with getting what we call off book, which means memorized.
Right. How different is the actual acting style when one is acting Shakespeare versus acting something that is not Shakespeare, or in particular something that's much more contemporary? I mean, I think to somebody casually looking in from the outside, it seems like it has maybe a certain air of artificiality or kind of a larger-than-life quality to it or something like that, not quite so nitty-gritty realistic as we think of, at least with certain other kinds of acting. Do you buy into that kind of distinction, or do you feel like all acting is essentially the same thing and that the way somebody acts in a Shakespeare play should not be profoundly different from the way they act a role in a play by Tennessee Williams or something like that?
Absolutely. I hate phony Shakespeare. There's nothing I hate more than, you know, I say to my students all the time, it's that perfect storm of you've got three dudes standing in triangle formation facing, you know, slightly out to the audience because they're cheating out because it's proscenium, and they're all speaking in very deep manly tones and essentially shouting at each other, and there's no meaning to the language whatsoever. I want to see truth and honesty. I want to see these characters dealing with these huge challenges, you know. But I want to see that in any play. Shakespeare in Hamlet, I think it's Act 3, Scene 2, Hamlet is talking to the player king, who is his favorite actor, because Hamlet is a theater geek, because why wouldn't he be? And he says to the player king, "Speak the speech, I pray you, as I pronounced it to you, trippingly on the tongue. But if you mouth it, as many of your players do, I had as lief the town crier speak my lines." And the entire speech is an actor's manual on naturalistic acting.
Wow.
He says that hold as 'twere the mirror up to nature. Suit the word to the action to the word. And it's this brilliant piece. It's this brilliant, it's literally Shakespeare saying, this is how you have to act my plays. And it's 200 years and several countries to the left, depending on where you're looking at the map,
right,
of Russia and Stanislavski's theory of realistic acting. So now that said, you have to technically, you have to attack the language. There is a muscularity to it. You can't,
right,
you can't speak this stuff casually. And you have to bring the energy. You have to bring the fire to the scene. So it's four-footed, not, you know, you're not on your heels with this stuff.
Right.
It's actor-athlete kind of stuff. The stakes are huge. It is live or die. And it's, at best, it's always in the moment.
Mm.
You know, I talk to my actors about put it on the line, act on the line, make the discovery right then and there. because otherwise it's just a bunch of people reporting on things they've already figured out. And that's boring. Nobody wants to see that.
Lose the visceral nature. Reminds me of why I think even a singer, a young singer, a voice student who really is only interested in musical theater, and many of them tend to only be interested in very contemporary musical theater that's very close to the musical style that is close to them and means the most to them. It is my abiding belief that somebody like that also needs to sing a love song written in 1750 in Italian, because just as an expressive exercise to have to be as persuasive in conveying love for someone in sort of antique music and in a foreign language. I mean, you exercise expressive muscles that you otherwise don't need to exercise when it's something really, really close and accessible to you. Not that the other is better than the other.
Absolutely.
But it is a different experience for the performer, albeit one that they might not, at least at the outside, find as enjoyable or as
as
natural and effortless.
My first audition a very long time ago at Steppenwolf Theater Company in Chicago, I had been told no Shakespeare, you know, modern edgy pieces. And I did my audition, and I was on my way out, and the casting director at the time hollered after me. He said, "Brian," I said, "Yeah, what's up?" And she said, "Do you have any Shakespeare?" And I started laughing, and she said, "I know we don't do Shakespeare." I said, "Okay, well," I said, "can I ask why you want to see me do a Shakespeare?" And she said, "If you can do a Shakespeare, you can do anything." And I said, "Okay," and I did a Shakespeare. And she was pleased with it. But yeah, I totally agree with that. You know, even if you are doing up to the minute modern 21st century theater, a foundation in Shakespeare will always serve you well.
Well, certainly your students have had to enjoy this experience of encountering this comedy called Love's Labor's Lost, as you said earlier in the interview, set in the 1920s, which sounds like a really, really intriguing choice. And with just a couple of days of rehearsal left, you are feeling good about the preparation?
I am, yeah. You know, the we're in dress rehearsals now. That final week is always a sprint to the finish line. But the whole process has been just fun, been enjoyable. It's always fun watching. As I said, it's always fun watching actors hear Shakespeare and realize that, oh my God, this is a modern play.
Yeah, it speaks to us all these years later, hundreds and hundreds of years later.
Absolutely.
So Love's Labor's Lost opens this weekend at the University of Wisconsin Parkside and runs the following weekend as well. Is this on the main, the ComArts Theater
stage? This is in the Rita. This is the Black Box space,
okay,
which I love dearly.
Right. There's all kinds of interesting things that can be done in there.
Yes, indeed.
And it's often a very close and intimate experience for the audience. So if people are interested in attending, what should they do?
They can call the box office at 262-595-2564. They can also visit the box office online at boxoffice@uwp.edu.
Very good. Brian Gill, the director of the University of Wisconsin Parkside's production of Shakespeare's Love's Labor's Lost. Fun to talk with you.
Always good to see you, Greg.
And
thank you.
Best wishes to you and your cast. And here's a little more of Gerald Finzi's incidental music to Love's Labor's Lost to finish out part one of today's morning show here on WGTD.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Public Radio. I'm Gregory Berg.
This Friday, the 3rd of May, is a very special event, which is aligns with the longtime celebration of the University of Wisconsin Parkside's 50th anniversary. 50 years in the business of higher education and 50 years of connecting with the outside community. And they are having a very special event this Friday, a nonprofit breakfast, one of many such events which they have hosted over the years. And for this very special 50th anniversary edition, if you will, they have invited a very special guest to be part of the proceedings, Susan Dreyfus, who is president and CEO of the Alliance for Strong Families and Communities, which is a strategic action network of social sector organizations. And she will be the keynote speaker for Friday's event, speaking at 10 o'clock in the Student Center about a special report which the Alliance commissioned, which examines the impact of community-based organizations, the difference that they make in people's lives, and the forces that sometimes keep them from doing the work that they otherwise set out to do. We have a few minutes to speak with Susan Dreyfus about this. We welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks, Craig. It's great to be with you.
Explain, first of all, how you are using the term community-based organization, or CBO.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's interesting. In Latin, nonprofit means no progress. And in essence, nonprofit is simply a charitable tax status that our sector enjoys, and something that's very important to our connection to community and community's connection to us. That being said, though, we believe that the use of the term nonprofit in some ways can equate to non-business, or people not seeing these organizations as more than charities. So as we got into our report, one of the things we realized is that there is a lack of understanding of the larger value that our sector brings to society. And so from that work, where we landed was that we really are community-based, human-serving organizations across the country and a critical third sector in America. But the continued use of simply nonprofit to describe us doesn't get at the essence of who we are, why we are, what we do, and how we do it.
Right. So community-based organization is a more helpful label or helpful title. And at its heart, of course, it is the idea of an organization that is based right in the community versus some other kind of organization that might do good work in the community, but does it from afar. I assume that that distinction is really important.
That's super insightful on your part, Greg, and I really appreciate that because one of the things, most of my career has been spent in the public sector. I was honored to be the first administrator of the Division of Children and Family Services under Governor Tommy Thompson years ago here in Wisconsin. And I just didn't know what I didn't know as a public sector leader, and that is the larger role and value of this critical third sector in America. We were created by community, for community, in community. We're governed by community. We're one of the things that blows me away in this sector is voluntary governance. A board members who come together from across the community to ensure that all people in their community can do well. And if you really think about it, at the heart of our sector and something now that our country is just finally realizing as it's being confronted with the massive expense of health care and the, what seems like the intractable ability to get to better health and bend that cost curve is really our sector builds the human capital of America. We are critical to a vibrant society. And it's really important that people understand that we're not just providers of programs and services under contract with government. We are critical agents of change in community and build our country's greatest asset, and that's our people.
So the Alliance for Strong Families and Communities, of which you are the head, commissioned a special report to examine the importance of community-based organizations And one of the things that I found most interesting as I read your executive summary is not so much about the good that they do, although I think that's, of course, absolutely essential, but you go into some really intriguing specifics about the roadblocks that keep community-based organizations from accomplishing as much as they otherwise would. And one of the roadblocks, which you touched on earlier in the interview, is that of public perception, of the general public not fully appreciating the significance of such organizations. Beyond that, talk about some of the operational shortcomings and capacity constraints that also are a hindrance to such organizations.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, if you ask me what can keep me up at night in my job, and remember the Alliance is a national strategic action network of organizations across the country, and so, you know, I get the honor and the privilege of moving around the nation and kind of having a lens to what's happening. And if you ask what can keep me up at night, it's really two things. I've been in health and human services now for over 30 years. And I've never been more hopeful in my life. Never have I been more hopeful in my career that we're standing at the cusp of being able to achieve breakthrough results in this nation that we have long always wanted. We are not going to solve these issues one program, one service at a time, whether we're talking about what feels intractable about poverty, whether we're talking about what it's going to take to bend that cost for health care and get better health, whether we're talking about every child in this nation being able to succeed in education. And I've never been more hopeful in my career that we're standing at the ability to do that. And yet we know that to do that, no one of us gets that job done alone. It truly takes an ecosystem of interconnected actors, with our sector being but one of them. The other thing that can keep me up at night, the first one is my great hope that we will seize this moment. My second is a fear. And my second is that I worry that what America's not understanding is the critical role of this sector and how financially fragile it is. And one of those roadblocks that is very important in this report is that if we are going to achieve the breakthrough results we want to achieve through this larger power of ecosystem, public sector in partnership with our sector, in partner with education, in partnership with healthcare, in partnership with law enforcement, that truly can get breakthrough results to happen in partnership with the faith community, then the sector has to be able to be its best self. And this was one of the most rigorous 990 reviews. 990s are what community-based human service organizations, any quote-unquote nonprofit in America, must fill out a 990 form, and it is publicly available information on the financials and other information about the organization. This report commissioned the most rigorous 990 review ever done. And we looked at over 45,000 organizations over a three-year period of time. We could track change over that period of time. And this is what we found. There's 218,000 of these community-based organizations in this country today, the organizations I'm talking about. They provide critical human services, right? Behavioral health care, housing, early childhood, older adult services and supports, you name it, domestic violence. And there's 218,000 of them. Their collective spend is $200 billion, which might sound like a lot to someone, right? But when you match that against the total spend in our nation on healthcare, which is close to $4 trillion, it is like an eyedropper in Lake Michigan, okay? The reality is that we found is that these organizations are operating many times on less than 30 days of operating cash. Now, that is a problem, and that can keep me up at night, that this critical sector has basically become financially so fragile. And what our country needs to understand, what funders need to understand, what policymakers need to understand, that was one of the roadblocks in this report, is you can't build the organizational capacities you need, the people that you need, the technology that you need, the level of infrastructure that you need to be able to have for your people to achieve their greatest results. You can't get that done if you don't have the cash to pay for it. And so that was a huge eye opener, I think, for many people, because what was really amazing is that the organizations at 10 million of operating revenue and above were not that healthier, were not that much more healthy financially than the smaller organizations.
And you know, it's interesting. We often talk about the praiseworthy efforts of community-based organizations to accomplish all that they do with constrained funds, not stopping to realize that those constraints can also choke such organizations and sometimes kill them off altogether, and particularly at a time when we are dependent on these organizations more than we ever were before. It is critical that we face up to this. We have just a couple of minutes left, but I want to move on to your recommendations, and there are many that you make, including being open to innovation and strategic partnerships and so on, and all of this is spelled out in your recommendations. You also say that it is a time in which we need to modernize regulations, and that this can make a huge difference in the well-being of these community-based organizations. What are you getting at there?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and just for your listeners to know as they go to the report on our website and really delve into it, is there's not a single recommendation in this report that we did not find happening somewhere in the country. And so I'll use Colorado as the example on this one. But the bottom line is no different than business. And right now as a nation, we are really all about regulatory reform, especially at the federal level, and governors are, for their businesses. These organizations are businesses too. And while some regulation is critically important, and we always have to keep mind of that because it ensures equal access and treatment of all people, it ensures critical levels of safety, we need regulation. And so I'm not saying don't swing a pendulum too far. But what we found is just classic, outdated, duplicative, very costly with very little return, conflicting regulations. An organization that in one program is being regulated by five different state agencies, right? And some of their regulations are in conflict with one another. Now, try wrestling with that, right? So we've got some organizations that have so many regulatory entities that they work with. They've got somebody that's all they do. Well, that's a capacity issue, right? We're taking dollars and having to use it in that way. Governor Hickenlooper out in California, he said enough of this. And just as he was trying to give regulatory relief to for-profit business, he said, we've got to do it for our nonprofit partners, too, because they're critically important to the state of Colorado. They went through a process. They reduced regulations on the sector by 20%, and they put in place a process that not a single regulation could be changed or could be created without it first going through a community-based organization panel to really get underneath why is it needed, how is it needed, how best do we do this if we need to do it? And if we don't need to do it, let's stop now.
Wow. Susan Dreyfus, she is going to be the keynote speaker for this Friday's nonprofit breakfast at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, celebrating 50 years of powerful partnerships. More information about Friday's event is available by calling 595-2635 or going to the website of University of Wisconsin Parkside and searching for nonprofit breakfast. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackandrea.com. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. More information about admission.